This week's show with Beth Hoyes of Rabbit Hat Designs is sponsored by Avlia Folk Embroidery at avliaembroidery.com. Designer Krista West is featuring four new designs: the Bit Kit Dianthea, which is from a vintage Latvian needlework booklet, the Ativarian Star and Vine, which is from a bed tent curtain from the island of Rhodes, Venetian Coins, which is a fun little all-over number on a great color palette, and Latvian Berries Table Runner, which is a simple yet gorgeous berry border motif from a vintage Latvian needlework booklet. Also, Krista will be our guest on the March 2 Fiber Talk Stitch Hour, when we'll talk about these new designs and the inspirations behind them. Visit avliaembroidery.com to shop for these and Krista's entire catalog of designs. And thanks to Avlia Folk Embroidery for sponsoring the show. Now on to our conversation with Beth Hoyes. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from Rabbit Hat Designs, Beth Hoyes. Beth, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Yes, hello. Happy to be here. Hi, Beth.
Yeah, we got a double Beth show here today. I got to be careful.
Yes. Which Beth you're talking to?
I know. Yes, that's yeah. Yeah.
Could
yeah.
get confusing for sure.
Yep. Okay, Beth Hoyes. Yes. I know someone who does music therapy, and so it stands to reason that there is a field of art therapy. So how does that work?
So it's a real it's kind of one of those things that's kind of difficult to put in a nutshell. It's quite a kind of complex way of working, but I will do my best. So I think the main thing with art therapy is it works like lots of other forms of therapy, like psychotherapy, but there's the element obviously of the art, which plays a huge role in it. And the art is very much seen as, you know, a really diverse way of working. So you work with lots of different materials, lots of different processes. And it's quite, the way I've been trained was to work very spontaneously with the client. So whatever they feel works for them in that session at that time for whatever they want to express or work through is what they're drawn to. So you work, you know, and I would work with children and families. So, I would provide pretty much anything you could imagine art material wise. So there was clay and buttons and glitter and, you know, fiber and all sorts of things. And then it's very much, you know, working with whatever they bring to the session and whatever they're working through. Generally, I would work with young people, children and families who had quite severe trauma or displacement, sometimes bereavements, all sorts of different reasons that they have come into therapy. And the art really becomes a symbolic, meaningful process within the sessions together. And there's a real element of working with kind of bringing the unconscious to the conscious and making it more manageable. So things that have maybe been interrupted or have been difficult for people in early relationships can be reworked within the session through the relationship and through the art making. And it's about creating a very safe, creative space. And the art can work in so many different ways. It's, you know, has a potential for infinite meanings and functions. So some functions are things like it can be a vessel for painful experiences and hold on to them until they feel ready, you know, to express them or to kind of understand what the feelings are that they brought to the session. So the art becomes all sorts of different things, like a container, a vessel. It can feed back painful emotions in a more manageable way. And it's basically like visualizing whatever they're struggling with. I hope that makes sense. It's one of those things that's difficult to kind of, explain in a few sentences. But
No, well, see, we've done several shows and had several conversations about the meditative properties of needlework. And so then when we see someone who's an art therapist, then I start to wonder, well, how does this on a larger scale, how does this all come together? So is it art? Does art serve the purpose of giving the brain a release so that it can relax and let some of the issues come out, or I'm sure it depends, but
yes, definitely. It can definitely function that way. And I think the art is really multifaceted within the sessions. It can really serve different functions for different people at different times. So I think stitching in particular, though, is one that I think it does provide this really meditative process. And I found when working with young people and children that when they were struggling with displacement or loss, like having several foster homes, that kind of experience, that actually the stitching materials would be really kind of something that drew them in and would provide this sense of binding experiences together, of creating this attachment and this comfort, you know, within the sessions. And then it's something they could keep as well. And I think that's a really valuable thing, is that, you know, the children would be creating something that then they could take with them, you know, and it's something that can remind them of the sessions and the safety, or, you know, that feeling that that making that artwork brought to them. And I think stitching in particular is such a soothing way of working that it did come up a lot, especially with my young clients. But, you know, I think it works for any age, really. But yeah, just from my experience, stitching in particular was one people were drawn to.
The University of Iowa, where my son went for when he had leukemia, they had a lot of art supply, art therapy going on. And that was one of the things, because a lot of the kids were, you know, angry. Some of them, they had, their parents had to leave them literally at the hospital because they had to work.
Yeah, and so they're hard. Yeah.
This, and they needed a way to express their emotions, and especially young children. They don't have the vocabulary. They don't understand everything that's going on. So they have these issues, and the art helped them to express that. And you just reminded me of that, I remember my son Sam doing some of those things, but he did needlework at that time. At the time, that was when he did a lot of the needlework he did, because, you know, you're sitting there for hours. What are you going to do?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I think something that's great about art making in general is it just speaks, I think, so well to that, like, intuitive kind of embodied way of being, isn't it? Because it's something, I think, you know, a lot of children are kind of drawn to making things, or, you know, constructing things naturally. And, you know, and like you said, it's a way of, you know, expressing feelings and expressing experiences, which doesn't have to be verbal. So you don't have to kind of go into lengthy explanations. You can just kind of be in the artwork and in the process. So I think that's really powerful.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. This is interesting to me. So is most of the art therapy that you do kind of at the craft level, like cutting up pieces of paper, gluing things together, drawing crayons, that kind of thing? Or depending on the client, do you escalate the art, if you will?
It would be a real mix, but I think it really depends on the client group. It varies a lot, like you were saying. It depends, you know, because some people would come to art therapy from an art background, so they might want to do printmaking, or they might want to do something that involves a bit more materials or a bit more preparation. And then you might have other people who are coming to art for the first time, that, you know, or at least they feel it's the first time really kind of delving in. And so you just kind of pitch it at wherever people feel ready. And I think for me, you know, working with children, families and young people, it was a lot of, the kind of more craft side of things, where you're offering lots of different things and just letting them kind of feel whatever feels best to them at the time. But I know a lot of art therapists who work with themes as well, and work with, you know, things that they set up and prepare ahead of time. And I think there can be some really powerful, really great groups where you might do, say, a group for young people with animation, or you might do a group for young people on lino, you know. So I think it is one of those things that it just really varies, and each therapist will have really different ways of working as well within that. So it is kind of one of those things where, you kind of pitch it depending on who you're working with, I guess.
I knew the answer was it depends. It's always the answer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So did your interest in needlework and art come before the therapy? Is that what drove getting involved in art therapy, or did that come after?
Yeah, I think I was interested in art therapy from quite a young age. I think for me, art provided quite a therapeutic way of expressing myself when I was quite young. And I think that led me towards art therapy from quite a young age. I was always one of those kids who was like doodling on everything, drawing, painting, wanting to play with everything. And I also had hearing problems, which were undiagnosed for quite a while. And I was actually profoundly deaf for about a year. And it wasn't known that I was. So I had no real way of communicating, and you know, and so I think that really drew me towards art, because it was a way I could be and just have that intuitive kind of relationship with the world without having to puzzle out, you know, conversations or what I should be doing, you know, in the human world. So I think that also took me towards nature and animals as well, because it's that sense of just being. And the embroidery was definitely something I dabbled in as a child, and kind of from when I learned to hold a needle, it was definitely something I was using as a toolkit of lots of different things. And but then I think over time it definitely became something that just more bubbled up for me when we moved to Colorado. So that's kind of when I started, which is about 4 years ago now.
So that's when things really intensified needlework wise.
Yes. Yeah. And part of it, I think, was the move, because I suddenly had a lot of time, because I couldn't get my art therapy accreditation here translated. And, you know, a lot of the accreditations and things like that are different. And they're actually the same level of skill that you need, but just it gets lost in translation just because all the credits for unis are different. So it's a bit of a palaver trying to get it all sorted. So I had a lot of time. You know,
welcome to America.
Away. Yes. Yeah, well, I think from what I've heard, it has happened the other way around as well. So I think it's a fairly common experience of moving countries, you know. But yeah, so it definitely started when I had this space, because I suddenly had all this space to be like, okay, what am I going to do? And I think, you know, just embroidery naturally came to me. It was something that I just really wanted to do more of. And so that's kind of where it all started, really, was just with that move and just having the space to let it bubble up, I think, and follow my nose. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. All right. A creative family. I mean, it sounds like you grew up in an environment where creativity was always an option.
Yeah, I feel like it wasn't really something that was necessary. Like, my parents hadn't worked in art before or studied in art before, but I think we were encouraged to be quite like expressive and free and playful. And I think, you know, we were pretty wild growing up. We were allowed to kind of just play in the woods for hours and, you know, and just kind of design our own games. And we'd be building stick dens and stuff like that. So I think that kind of maybe helped with the creativity of just feeling free to, you know, just dabble and you know, not be scared to try new things and that kind of thing.
Yeah, kids today miss out on that. Get outside and go play in the woods for a while. And I don't want to hear from you. Yeah, you...
Yeah. Yeah. We were kind of called back at mealtimes. That was kind of,
right. Yeah. Yeah. When the meal timer and then you're home when the street lights come on, and that's the rule.
Yeah.
And otherwise you're free. Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, it's now I feel like it's quite lucky to have that experience, isn't it? I feel like it's quite hard sometimes, you know, depending on your environment and where you're growing up. And, you know, and I think it's one of those things that my sister works in. Actually, she's a conservationist. And so she does a lot of trying to introduce kids to nature in cities. So she was working in London and trying to get kids to kind of be interested in bugs and trees and, you know, planting things and all of that kind of thing. Because I think it is, even if you're in a city, there's always pockets of nature to explore, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, my sister, younger sister is a special ed teacher, science and special ed. And she just started a job this year with a school. It's a private school. And they have regular curriculum in the morning. And then at some point midday, they are outside. And they are outside for the rest of the day, and it's year round. And weather is not a factor. Just dress for it. And she is absolutely having the time of her life with these kids, because my sister is a real outdoors person, and just having the time of her life teaching. I've never heard her happier. I mean, she'd gotten to the point where she had to go to therapy because the special ed and the usual grind of teaching had just run her down. And now she is just loving it, and they're outdoors all the time. And every time I talk to her, it's, you know, I just remember we as kids, you know, there was a huge woods behind our house. And I mean, we just would spend days out there. Yeah. Like you said, making up games, sliding on hills, all kinds of things. And that is just so missed these days. The kids just don't have those opportunities.
Yeah, I think it really varies, doesn't it? Yeah, but I think that was something that a lot of parents I would work with were kind of worried about, leaving their children to be outside. And, you know, in the areas I used to work in, they would want their kids to have that opportunity, but they'd be kind of struggling to feel safe to do that. So I think, yeah, it's a very different maybe environment in some places, but I suppose it varies a lot still. But yeah, I think there is maybe more fear around letting children just kind of run away for the day, or, you know, there's a definite difference, I think, with how maybe people approach it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and in many cases, justifiably so. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And even, and now, you know, I know a lot of the homeschool movements, they encourage, you don't need a lot of space, but just, you know, go out and look at like a square. You send your kids out and have them look at like a square yard or area and have them see what they see. What do you observe here?
Yes,
and you make them stop and look. And that takes time to do, you know.
Definitely.
Down there. And we've missed that. And that, and I think that encourages creativity, you know, observation, all the things we need in this modern society of ours. I'd love to see that encouraged more, but it's hard to do. It's hard. You can't just say, okay, yeah, go out by yourself in the middle of
yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I feel like it's something that maybe it would be great. Like, and I know that a lot of schools already do it, but it would be great, wouldn't it, to have that, you know, inbuilt into the curriculum a bit more, where it's like, you know, nature observation or something, you know, where it's like, you know, an hour or two a day, you're just kind of doing that, you know, like you were saying, Gary, with, was it your sister?
Yeah.
Yeah, that, you know, and I actually have a background working in special education as well before I went into art therapy. And I do think, we spent so much time outside and, you know, just playing with things, you know, sticks and all sorts of things. And, you know, and I think it can be really valuable just being out there, can't it? But yeah, it is one of those things that really depends on the situation.
Yeah, and Beth, homeschooling your kids, yeah, that gives you a real opportunity because you know where your kids are at, but you also can expose them to those things.
Right, right. Yeah. Gave me the opportunity. We could say, okay, we're going to go and do a nature walk today. That'll be what we're doing for science.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's just harder to do in a more formalized setting.
Definitely. Yeah.
It's just the way society is, and you know we need to kind of bring some of that back. I think we miss that, and it shows in some of the lack of, you know, just letting your kids go out there and play allows them to, again, be spontaneous, be creative, you know, take some risks, some chances moms don't like to see, you know.
Yes, yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
it's that kind of playing within the limits, isn't it? But it's having that kind of freedom to experiment. And I think I still feel lucky, you know, looking back and just how much freedom we had with that. And I think it does, you know, for me, it does play into a lot of how I work and how I am, I think, you know, because it's taught me to be quite flexible and think on my feet quite a lot, which has been really valuable.
Yeah. Is that also what drives, I mean, your business, Rabbit Hat Designs, you're very, everything you do is very sensitive to the ecology and the global whatever. Does that stem from that your sensitivity to nature and our environment?
Yeah, I think so. I think we had empathy for nature instilled in us quite a lot. I think from our parents, they were very kind of keen on introducing us to nature and, you know, and letting us be outside a lot. And you know, and even on walks would kind of point out things to us a lot, you know. And I think we were really brought up feeling we're not separate to nature. You know, it is part of our world and we're reliant on it. And that interdependency, rather than seeing it as something that's kind of just alongside us, it's more more understanding that we depend on a lot of nature, and that it's that kind of living alongside each other, but letting that kind of intertwine a little bit, rather than keeping it very separate. So I think it came from a very young age as well. And, you know, yeah, and just kind of our parents just reminding us of that, really, rather than, you know, that we are separate and not thinking about it or anything. You know, it was something that was kind of in our minds a lot as kids, I think. And I think there has been kind of an increasing disconnect between people and nature over time. So I think with my work at the moment, especially, and within the last year or so, it's definitely got more and more focused on nature and just kind of raising awareness around vulnerable species and just our part in that, you know, in terms of understanding that we do have an impact. I think as well, just wanting to also evoke just that sense of immersion and empathy with nature and connection, so that it doesn't feel like something that's a pest, you know, or something that's kind of just like around, or like itchy bugs, or, you know, that kind of thing. But thinking of it more as this thing that surrounds us and is part of us, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, just about all that you do with your embroidery designs is nature, animals. I love the macro stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you really speak to me, because I at one point was doing a lot of photography, and macro photography is what I love to do. But it isn't just getting up close to a flower. It's, to me, it's getting even closer. And the parts. And when we look at your butterfly wings, that's exactly the kind of photography I love doing, is getting right in close, because there's so much in there close that people overlook, the spots and the lines and the flow of things. And you just bring that out, and it's really a pleasure to look at.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so lovely to hear. I feel like it's been such a lovely process delving into that, actually, because I started out doing more the whole bee, you know, mini beasts, I call them, but I'm not sure if that's like a formal term. But like, you know, started doing moths and butterflies. And I think at first I was really drawn to the symbolism of the transitions that they survive, you know, in a lifetime, that they're these really resilient little creatures that go through these giant changes. And I think with me changing countries, it was related to that a lot. So I was drawn to the butterflies and moths initially with that. But then I think over time, I was delving into the layers of the culture here and learning more and kind of zooming in. And it's funny, because then there was this parallel process of me zooming in, you know, into the species I was working on and looking closer at their feathers or their wings, or, you know, and looking at all these tiny little details that we often overlook, you know. And so there was this kind of parallel process going on there, I think. But I also really love that idea of curiosity and inviting curiosity. And so I think the macro for me was that kind of natural step of just wanting to delve deeper and wanting to explore a bit more and kind of bring that out. And then they just got bigger and bigger. And it's just been a real joy, actually, to kind of, you know, and that kind of wonder in it, you know, where you can just like invite that immersion in nature. I really love that side of macro, and I love macro photography. That's actually kind of the first image I think that I worked on was related to a macro photo I saw of butterfly wing, and I was just fascinated by the fact that they're these tiny, tiny microscopic scales, you know, and that they reflect back all these different colors. And it was just like, for me, I was like, whoa, you know, there's like this whole world there, you know, all this mini world that we're not seeing all the time.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing is, and I love how your macro pieces are these giant hoop designs. but that's just it.
Amplified.
Yeah, there's such a world up close, a whole different world that for most people is just never seen. And bringing that out is number one for embroidery. It's a ton of fun. But also just to help people see what beauty there is in the most minuscule things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, sometimes I like to think of them almost like magnifying glasses, you know, because they're round. They always make me think of looking through like a magnifying glass into something really tiny, you know, or what do you call them? Is it microscopes, isn't it? Just like really zooming in. And I love that they're all circular. You know, when you look at lenses, they're all kind of circular. And it makes me think of kind of portals almost, you know, that you're kind of being transported somehow.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I thought. I thought it's like I'm looking at a magnifying glass as close as I can get, or a microscope, and really zoom And yet those are, those hoops are huge that you're stitching.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, wow, that is just gorgeous work.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so lovely to hear. Yeah, it's funny because I think as an embroiderer, I'm often kind of working quite alone, really, you know, because you're kind of so immersed in the process and just kind of day to day, kind of working little bit by little bit on something. And it's so lovely sometimes for the pieces to have that interaction in the world, you know, and people get back to you and be like, oh, you know, I love the feeling of looking at it. That's such a great thing to hear, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in this time while you're trying to get accreditation, then that's when you were really able to develop this whole approach and experiment and try and just work it out till you got something you liked?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've always been someone who's bounced around different modalities, you know. I always felt a bit like I was trying to find the right fit with what I felt most at home with. And I never quite kind of settled on anything. And this has been the first way of working that I'm just like, oh, I love it. I just want to do it all the time. You know, so it's been really nice finding something where I just want to, like, you know, I'm just happy to keep going with it. Because I think beforehand I would, you know, try ceramics and do that for a few months. And then I would try bookbinding and do that for a few months. And I'd kind of try all these different ways of working. And it just never quite felt like I was really wanting to delve in and stick with it for a long time. So this has probably been the first time I've really kind of, you know, stuck with something and just really practiced and put all the energy in to kind of build it, really. And that's been a wonderful feeling as well, is just realizing, you know, that it takes this practice and this energy and just this repetition and trial and error. I think that's been a really good experience, just to have that time to really delve into it and spend time learning it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So were you self-taught then? Did you teach yourself embroidery?
I did, yeah. I've definitely looked at the odd YouTube for, like, tutorials, mainly just things like French knots or ruching the back of the embroidery, that kind of thing, where it's quite practical parts to it. But in terms of the actual kind of thread painting, that's definitely been something I've just gained over time. I suppose there is an element of, I guess, seeing things and working on them and giving it time and kind of drawing inspiration from other artists. But I do think, yeah, most of it's self-taught, of just me practicing and keeping going and just looking at reference images and doing my best to kind of recreate what I feel. But what one of the things I really love about art making and embroidery is, like, it goes through you and comes out, doesn't it? So it's like you're taking something in with your eyes, and then it kind of gets somehow kind of morphed as it goes through you and comes out through your way of seeing it. And so that's been just a really nice learning process within the embroidery. But yeah, I've never had any formal training in embroidery, but it is something now, because I love it and I've been doing it for a while, I'm like, oh, I wonder if I should look at it at some point of trying to learn some of it formally and see how that goes. But yeah.
Nah, it'll just mess you up. Don't do it.
Yeah, maybe I'll be going kind of backwards. I'm not sure.
No, stick with what you have. You're good.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
It works. It works.
Keep going. Yeah, it'll be fine. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't need the police telling you how to do things. No.
Yeah.
So yeah. What is your process? Are you starting with photos? Say, for instance, your butterfly macro things. Are you starting with photos? Do you make drawings? How do you go about this? How do you get from nothing to a finished piece?
So usually with the macros, especially, I work on black a lot, black fabric, which has been a really lovely way of working.
Yeah, we got to talk about that too, because holy smokes, that can be tough.
Yeah, it's an interesting color to work with for sure. So the process starts with photos mainly, and they will just be photos usually of the whole butterfly. And then I circle out the bit I want to zoom in on, and then I work from there. So I usually use a white pencil and sketch onto the black fabric. So they're just kind of normal drawing pencils. And I create the outline. So I just start with the minimal kind of lines to help guide me with where different colors change and that kind of thing. And I usually use reclaimed fabric if I can. So it's usually rummaging in Goodwill to find old curtains or bed sheets. I think that's something I found. Those two in particular, curtains and bed sheets, seem to be a good one to work on. But I also work sometimes, if I can't find any black versions, then I'll sometimes get Robert Kaufman linen. I found that's quite nice because it's got a quite nice texture. And I think from what I've read that it's a little bit more sustainable than some of the others. So it's kind of a process of drawing the outlines on, and then I add the detail. And I tend to do what I've done with modalities, where I kind of bounce around the image, and I start in one area and I'll just see what takes my fancy that day. So I'll be like, oh, I feel like working on the red part today, or the blue part, or, you know, so I'm quite spontaneous with how I add the stitches. And they all tend to be kind of series of straight stitches. Yeah, so it's kind of a bit of a spontaneous process, really. Not huge amount of structure to it.
That's okay. That's all right.
Yeah. And so, do you use the whole? What are you using for your thread? Are you using DMC floss?
I am. Yes. Yeah. So I use DMC. I find the colors are really great, and just the variety and diversity you can get. But also they have that lovely sheen as well, which really lends itself well to the butterfly aspect. And from what I've read, you know, they seem to be mindful of being fairly sustainable and natural dyes and things. But it's so tough. And I think it's one of those things that I try my best to pick products that I know come from sustainable sources and things. But I think it is something that, however much you read and research, it's quite hard and to get to the bare bones of it, you know, of where things have come from. And so I do my best. I definitely don't say I'm perfect, for sure. And it's a learning process, you know, of trying to find the right materials. But I think it is something that I try and be mindful of within my selection of threads and fabric and things like that. But yeah, I do find the DMC threads in particular. I just find the colors really great, just for such a wide spectrum.
Yeah. So, yeah, and I had that same question Beth did. Do you just use the whole strand of DMC? Because it looks like you do. Or do you pull the individual strands out?
So it varies. So when I work on animals, they're usually, so the animals mainly I've worked on have been for the Endangered Animal Challenge, which were once a month for a couple of years. I was doing a vulnerable species. So them I use thin threads, and I'll do thread painting, but with much smaller threads, where I'll usually do it with two of the strands or three. But with the macro ones, I'd use the whole thread. Yeah. And I find it creates the blobs of color I want. I feel like it feels a bit more like painting sometimes when I'm using the whole thread. I think it's just because it gives it that thicker, blobbier look, which is what I quite like with the giant ones, because it gives that sense of, yeah, dobs of color, if that makes sense.
Right. And it's making the lines that you need too.
Yes. Yeah.
Like if you're making the feathers.
Yes.
So the, yeah. It gives that texture.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's actually, yeah. And I almost see it as magnified, like in the same way I'm using bigger hoops, I use the bigger thread in a way. So I see it as like almost magnifying the process of when I'm working in smaller embroideries. Although I do tend to use thick thread quite a lot. I think I just like I like that it's a bit thicker and you get these kind of chunky colors when you use the whole thread. So I think especially my botanics, when I work on the botanical embroideries, I really like using the thick thread for that. And I think it's because it gives these kind of big chunky colors. But it's hard to say because I haven't really tried using the thinner thread. So I haven't compared yet on which ones are better. But I think because I kind of tend to follow my nose with, I feel like using the whole thread for this or the thin thread for that, I'll kind of, switch between the two. But I do tend to, smaller, I tend to use thinner, bigger, I tend to use thicker. That's roughly how I go about it.
So you're very intuitive.
Yeah, it varies a lot for sure.
It's an interesting approach because I know for me and for Beth, we're forever pulling out one of the six strands from DMC floss, and or two or three or whatever it might be. And it does, when you use the whole thread, it really does give a whole different vision to the piece. And yeah, in a lot of ways, when you use it, it gives, you create the lines that, like Beth said, for feathers or whatever, and it really brings that out where it might get lost if you used thinner threads. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's something that I stumbled across, really. It wasn't intentional necessarily. It was more just what I felt like drawn towards just using it. And I think actually, to be fair, now I'm remembering, sorry, you know, as you talk about something, sometimes you're like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Right.
But I remember when I started, I didn't realize you could separate them. So my first pieces were all thick thread just because I thought that's just how you used it. I didn't really realize there was another way of using it. And it was only over time that I was like, oh, I need this thinner detail, or, you know, especially with the botanics, I was like, oh, I need this like little, you know, seed pod, or I need this little, you know, flourish on the flower, or, you know, and then I started realizing, oh, I could make it smaller. And so I started making it smaller. And I think that's when I realized, oh, I don't need to use the whole thread all the time. So for me, it was more of an accidental discovery. But then once I discovered that, then I realized there was this whole world of people using, you know, thinner. And then I was seeing all these amazing details you can get with the thinner thread, you know. So I think it's whatever lends itself, isn't it, to what you're working on, and just being able to maybe switch is quite useful sometimes.
Right. Makes the DM floss, sea floss, so such a nice product. Yeah. It is so versatile, and it comes in so many colors.
Yes, but yeah, I think that's been a really great part for me, is just how many options there are with it. And I think also, yeah, just being, and I think, yeah, compared to a lot of other threads, it just separates a lot easier. So when you are wanting to do those thinner details or thinner designs, it's much nicer to just be able to like pull it apart without, you know, because I think I've tried other threads and sometimes you'll be just like, you know, covered in thread and all like tangled up trying to kind of get it separated, you know. So I think I definitely have found a difference there.
When you're
now, well, I want to
go ahead.
Wanted to ask you about brown cloth. You go source that at thrift stores. Is that your go-to? Is it just to make it more sustainable?
Yeah, definitely. And I kind of like the idea of just having a random color or something sometimes to work with. So I did some kits a while back where I just found this sage green kind of curtain, and I did a kit that was just until that curtain ran out. So I quite like the idea of just reusing.
I love that. I have X kits because the curtain's only so big.
Yes, exactly. But the funny thing was, is it ended up being one of the most popular ones. And I was like, oh, I can't really recreate it now. So it's just, you know, it's there in the world. And there's only that many out there, really. But it was a really nice, fun thing to do, because, yeah, I was like, this is how many we've got, and we're just going to go till I've run out of curtain. But yeah, so Goodwill has been great for that. As a translation for anyone listening in the UK, it's a bit like charity shops. Where some of the proceeds go to charities, is that right? For Goodwill, from what I've heard, yeah. And so it's secondhand kind of stuff, yeah.
And I was, it was at an estate sale the other day, and I found Irish linen there. It was napkins. And I'm like, oh, she was like, oh, is $8 too much for this? And I'm like, No.
You're like, I think that'll be okay. Yeah.
I'm not going to argue with you. And it was beautiful linen. And I found things that way too, going, you know, here in the States, you know, as people get older, they're those old linens that no one wants to use anymore. And reclaiming them.
Yeah, there's something nice, I think, about them having a second life, you know, and giving them a chance to be out in the world in a different way again. I think, and I definitely try my best to get most of my stuff from reclaimed fabric, but it can be kind of tricky sometimes, especially with the black that I want to use for the macros. It can be kind of a trickier one to find. I think, you know, I have found the odd curtain, the odd bed sheet that's black, but generally I sometimes have to source that linen elsewhere. But yeah, it varies a lot. I think I do really like the idea, though, of, yeah, giving fabrics a second life, especially, like you said, you can find these great linens and these great muslins, like, you know, that have been something else, and you can give them a new life. So that has been a nice experience.
Right. And I've actually, they'll end up, people don't realize it, but if people are going through estates and they don't, no one takes them, they go to the trash. That's where they end up.
Yeah, and that feels so sad. I know. Yeah, just the thought of them kind of wasting away somewhere. But I suppose at least they mostly biodegrade, I guess. But it depends, I suppose. But yeah. But on the other hand, yeah, it's just nice to give them that second chance, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Yeah.
Now you make me want to start hunting down estate sales just to get cheap linen.
Yeah, well, you can find some great stuff.
Yeah, because you don't think about that. Because, I mean, that's exactly what's going on these days is older people, you know, their kids don't want any of this stuff. And, boy, yeah, a stack of napkins, good linen napkins. Oh, boy, could use those for 100 things. Oh, boy.
Okay. Yeah, and they're kind of the perfect size as well. I mean, if you want to work on the smaller hoops and things, it's, you know, the perfect size to work with. If you're just doing some small details or small images, you know, it's kind of perfect for that size. Yeah.
And even, and Gary, I'm going to influence you even more. I was at this estate sale and it was a beautiful.
That's something new.
There were two pillows and just a cover sheet, and they had a beautiful cut work butterfly in them. And I think they were machine made, but they were beautiful. And $2 for the entire set. And the cotton sheeting on them was beautiful. And all I could think of is I could cut this up and make some, you know,
definitely
surface embroidery projects because it's a lovely weight. So
yes. Yeah. It's just lovely when you find things like that. I think that's part of the fun, isn't it? Is when you're rummaging and you find these amazing finds, you're like, yes, I can use this.
Right. And it was like the end of a sale. And I thought, okay, there was a lot of other linens there and most of them had been picked over, but these had been left. And I know that at the end of the sale, they're trying to empty the house. They would have been thrown away. And it's like, okay, I can use for these and give them new life. So it's nice. Yeah. It's nice.
So help me, Beth. Yeah. If I start tromping around at estate sales on Saturday afternoon, you're going to hear about it.
Yeah. Sounds like a good plan to me. Yeah. It's funny because I think that was, as an art therapist, you're always picking up leftovers as well, because I feel like a lot of the time you don't have a huge budget. And so you're working with, you know, leftover scraps of fabric, or, you know, you're going to fabric shops and saying, you know, have you got anything? You're just chucking out, you know, ends of rolls or whatever. And you end up collecting these amazing, you know, things. And, you know, often, you know, then the people you're working with will make these amazing things out of them. And they come to take on this whole new meaning, you know. And I think that was something I always really loved as well as an art therapist, is that you're always, you know, reusing all these things that get kind of abandoned or, you know, or aren't seen as useful, you know, old crayons or whatever. And, you know, but actually they bring so much joy as well. So,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, Beth, you obviously, you know, with ground cloth, but throughout your entire business, you go to what I would consider significant lengths to be eco-friendly with your packaging and your materials. I mean, you really carry that through. And a lot of people, it'll be a token effort. You can tell, well, you know, they're kind of trying. But you are stem to stern eco-friendly.
That's nice to hear. I feel like I'm trying my best. Like it's one of those things. Yeah, I feel like I often worry sometimes about that. Of, you know, because I think when you put a badge on that you're trying to do your best to be eco-friendly, it can be something that becomes a token thing. And so I'm always worried about that, that side of it, of, you know, wanting to actually stand by it and be like, okay, if I'm saying I'm doing this, then I really need to go all out to try my best to make everything as eco as I can. And yeah, and there's been some great discoveries through that as well. I've got a printer who does a lot of my envelopes. He's an eco printer called Greg Barber, and he does my envelopes for me, and it's all kind of sustainable printing processes and things. And it's actually been a fun, sometimes problem-solving element to it, where it's trying to find how you source things sustainably, how you try your best to, you know, make less impact, I suppose, as a business. And I know I'm just this, you know, drop in the ocean, really, when it comes to businesses. But it's one of those things that I think I do feel passionate about, and I try my best to stick with it and try my best to source everything as well as I can. It's definitely a learning process as well. I feel like, you know, having a conservationist sister, she makes me very aware of, like, sometimes you think you're being sustainable and you're not, you know. And so there's times where I'm like, oh, I've done this great thing. And then she's like, oh, but what about this? And then you're like, oh, yeah. And then she's like, what about this? You know, so I think it is one of those things that it can be something that's maybe easy to say, but harder to do. And so I think it is a learning process. And I think it is one of those things that I think is really important, that you'll never be perfect with it. And I think as long as you try your best and you think about it and you're mindful of it, I think that's, you know, as much as you can do in terms of your capacity, you know. So, yeah, so I do my best. I would say that's probably the short answer.
I think sometimes it's just making people aware of it too.
Yeah.
I think we've gotten so used to having I'm going to use plastics.
My
pen in my hand, that's a plastic pen that when it's empty, I will throw away.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and it's just something that we've gotten so used to, that we've gotten that mentality. So it kind of, even if you just see it, you're like, it makes you pause and makes you think, okay, so where is one thing I can do? And if we all do a little bit together, none of us can change everything in the world, but if we could change a little bit in our little area, I think it would make a difference.
Yeah, for sure. And I think if everyone started just making those small changes day to day, it would make such a big difference, wouldn't it? I think it's one of those things as well that's on so many different levels. And there's the one level of individuals and taking that, you know, those steps day to day. But I think there's also such a huge problem with just, you know, that can't really be solved by individuals and on the governmental level. And I think Greta Thunberg is really good at, you know, voicing that and making everyone aware of that, that, you know, however eco we try to be, there's also these huge movements that we can't control as individuals. But just that mindfulness and trying to maybe demand change where we can, but I think it's one of those things that's easier said than done, isn't it? I do think, you know, if all of us took those little steps, I do think I'm kind of on both ends, where I see that it needs to happen on a larger scale, you know, on government levels, but it also needs to happen individually, where everyone just day to day is maybe more mindful just about what we use and what we throw away and what we recycle and what we, you know, reclaim and what we don't. You know, I think there are a lot of little things and big things that are kind of needing to be changed, really. But yeah, it's kind of one of those things, though, where it feels better, doesn't it, having at least some capacity to change day-to-day habits and things, which does help a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The plastic thing, I've just kind of accepted we're not going to get away from plastics, but where my mental focus and where I've really become sensitive lately is single use plastics. How much of that there is that is just waste, and, you know, bottles, just containers. I appreciate that they're easy to blow mold plastic containers and fill them with liquid and ship, put them on store shelves. But, oh boy, all that's got to go somewhere. And, I wish there was a concerted effort just to start using more glass bottles, if nothing else, and get away from that single use stuff. I mean, you look at all the plastic bags we use in needlework. Sleeves for charts. And I've been saving those, and now it's getting to the point where now what am I going to do with all these?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like there needs to be some kind of, reusing plastic embroidery of some sort. Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe turn it into thread or something.
Right.
But I feel like that is one of my, that's one of the trickiest aspects, actually, with the business side of things, of trying to be eco. Plastic is one of my biggest battles, is trying to lessen, because when you order anything, I was trying to find ways to order things without it coming in loads of, plastic packaging and stuff. And it's quite difficult finding companies that don't send you extra plastic and bubble wrap and everything. So it is kind of a definitely something where it's, trial and error, and trying to find ways to use less, throw away plastic. But I think, there's also the level that needs to happen, a company level, where things like, so for example, companies like Amazon or whatever, if they had like a plastic free button you could press or something, where they would pack it in paper or into the plastic or whatever. But it's one of those things, isn't it, that it's working out all those different layers. And I think it can feel really overwhelming sometimes, trying to work out ways to be eco. And I think it's just also it's what's within people's means as well, isn't it? Because it's, everyone has different capacities with what they can take in and what they can manage day to day. And so I think it's one of those things of again, it's just a bit of a big problem to work out.
Right. Oh yeah. Yeah. Amazon. Yeah. They're just the packaging material with Amazon. The other day we got two shipments from Amazon. One in the standard single-use plastic bag that will go to a landfill and never rot away, and then the other in a complete eco-friendly paper package, all padded and everything, plastered all over, how you can recycle this, and it's biodegradable. And I just kind of stood there and held the two and go, okay, Amazon, you need to have a meeting somewhere, because you guys are talking about both sides of your mouth here. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really confusing sometimes, isn't it? Yeah, because sometimes when I get those eco ones, I'm always like, yes, it's so great to get one where you don't feel terrible, like throwing away all the stuff. But yeah, so I feel like maybe it's shifting a little bit. I feel like with the UK, because I sent a couple packages to my family from Amazon, and I was like, oh, sorry, sorry if they're covered in plastic, especially to my sister, who's the conservationist. And she was like, she's a good person to have, in the background, always being like nudging, she's and then she said, oh, actually, apparently in the UK, it's a lot more paper based now. And they don't do as much single use plastic with the Amazon stuff. But I suppose it's one of those things of gradually, the more people who ask for it, the more it might happen. But yeah, it's definitely something that might be shifting slowly. I mean, even the fact that we get the odd biodegradable one or the odd recyclable one, I think that's a win for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I actually, there's a tea company I order from, and it's my favorite tea company, because when it's packaged up, it's put in they make round tea bags. And they wrap the packaging. That's what they use for the packaging, what they punch the tea bags out of.
Yes.
I love that, because, what you do with all that waste.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, anywhere where there's companies working out those little ways to change is so great, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to run out of time. Coming up in June is your new book, Beautiful Birds.
Yes.
So
yeah.
We have to talk about this. So, all right. So tell us the story of the Beautiful Birds book.
Yeah. So it actually, it was someone from Quarto. It's Quarto and Walter Foster Publishing. They're kind of partner companies. But someone reached out to me from Quarto and just asked if I'd be interested. She had seen some of my work on the Endangered Animal Challenge. I'd done a kakapo, I think. And she was like, oh, I would really love to talk to you about this. And so it went from there, really. And it's one of those things where, for me, it was like a dream project, just because I love birds. And so choosing birds, they were like, yeah, you get to pick, this many birds to make patterns for. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's like a dream project. So I picked 12 altogether, and I set them in groups. So I've done like 4 close-ups, 4 that are birds in flight, and then 4 portraits, because I really wanted to just capture different things about different birds. And I like the way with close-up you can get some of the more, you know, colors and the more detail. And then with the in-flight, you've got these amazing wing structures for some of the birds. And then the portrait for the birds where you kind of want to capture them on the whole like a puffin. You know, you can, I feel like you can't do a puffin without trying to capture their beak and feet.
Right, yeah.
Although that's not necessarily true. I've seen some amazing puffins that are just faces. But I did have that, like there's certain ones where I was like, oh, I just really want to capture, you know, the whole bird. So it was a bit of a mix. Yeah, and I designed each pattern and stitched them myself and then took progress shots. And I basically was trying to make it as easy as possible to follow. I think the biggest challenge was finding a way to create really detailed patterns that were also fairly easy to follow and didn't feel really daunting. So I've kind of broken them up into a lot of stages and provided a lot of color charts and stitching flow diagrams, things like that, just to make it as easy as possible. Yeah, so I just wanted to make thread painting in general feel a bit more accessible. I think it, for a lot of people, it feels maybe a bit scary at first, or a bit like really detailed, or, you know, a bit overwhelming. And so it was a way to make it feel a bit approachable.
Yeah. So is this a, it sounds like it's a project book, but then also I assume some pages of basic instruction. Here's how to go about this thing. And then here's the design that you can copy onto your cloth, and here are the colors, and have at it.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, so each pattern has its template that you can cut out of the book and use. Yeah, and then each one also has a color guide with all the thread colors you'll need and things like that. And then the beginning of the book, there's an intro which has a lot of the, you know, the kind of stitches you'll be using and how to blend, you know, in that thread painting style. And so there's a lot of kind of tips on how to go about stitching the birds at the beginning, which then kind of guides you through the book. And so you can kind of refer back to those when it says, oh, you use this stitch at this point, you know, you can kind of go back to the beginning and check what that stitch was, that kind of thing. And there's a couple stitches in there that I've learned just from doing it myself, which I'm not sure are official stitches, but they're ones that I was like, oh, these are really useful for kind of getting the feather flow or for getting certain patterns going. So there's also a few in there that just come from me having done it and realizing what's helpful. So it's a bit of a mix of official stitches and stitches that I found that, you know, as I was stitching them, that helped, you know, with stitching the birds.
Yeah, it's okay to make up stitches.
I know. I'm like, hopefully that's fine. But yeah, there's a couple stitches in there where I think I've called one scattered stitching. And I like the image of like throwing stitches out, a bit like feeding birds, you know, like you throw the seeds out and it's kind of like, you know, you imagine the stitches just falling kind of in that haphazard kind of way. But to create that fuzziness, you know. But yeah, so I was like, this is the best way I can describe it. Yeah.
Great. So how did you choose your birds?
They gave me actually, so the person who originally reached out to me sent me a list that she liked. And so I went through them and then I added a few of my own. And, you know, a lot of the ones she sent me actually were ones I would have chosen anyway. So that was really nice. We were on the same page with that. And they're basically just a lot of animals I really admire, a lot of birds that I see out and about and birds that I've loved seeing in the past and that they've always had that. And I think it harks back to what I was saying earlier about that, you know, with nature and that fascination in nature. I think there's just been certain birds that really stand out to me that I remember really vividly from when I first saw them, for example, or something. So I've got things like swallows. We had a lot of those around our house when I was young and we'd see them kind of fly in, and just seeing them fly is amazing. You know, so there's all sorts of different birds in there. I think some of my favorites are barn owls, there's a cardinal and a raven, kingfisher, and then hummingbird is probably my favorite, just because we see them out in Colorado and to me they're still just magic, you know.
Oh, they are. They are.
Yes, they're magical creatures, they are for sure. Yeah.
So you stay true to the bird color, very accurate, or did you take some license and have more of an interpreted bird design?
So I'd say I definitely aim to be quite exact with the colors. So I was using reference images, photos of birds that I was using as inspiration. Mm-hmm. So I tried my best to stick as closely as possible to the real bird colors. But I find a lot of people, when they see my work, say it's kind of almost brighter than what they are in real life, because I think I tend to draw on colors that maybe are there subtly, but I kind of bring them out more with the thread. So I think there probably is a brightness to the patterns, where they, that probably again is that, you know, magical slight element to it, where they're maybe a touch brighter than what they would be in real life through my interpretation. But I have aimed to make them as realistic as possible, really.
Yay. Yeah, no, because I mean, that's got to be a choice early on. Is do I go more abstract, interpretive, or do I stick to nature? So,
yes. Yeah, and I think probably with most of my work, I tend to be fairly realistic, because even the macros are related to photos. I don't tend to be too abstract. Although I suppose the macros probably appear abstract a lot. And they're definitely my interpretation of the image. So there is definitely some playfulness there. But I think generally I tend to go with, you know, my interpretation of the reality, which I suppose in itself is a little bit abstract because it's kind of going through me. But there's definitely a realistic element to the birds are probably some of the most realistic, where I have tried to stick to their colors. Because I think with a lot of the birds, it's kind of trying to, you know, capture them in the way they are, because they're kind of great as they are as well. So that's been nice.
Right. Enjoyable process putting the book together, such that you jump right into another one, or one of those things where I need a break and then I'll think about it?
Oh, no, it's been a really awesome process, actually. And I was lucky with the timing, because they got in touch when I was pregnant. And I had I think it was 2 months before our baby was due. So I squeezed it in, the first bit of work into before we had our baby. And then I finished the book after he was about a month old. So I had a bit of a pause in between. And they were so great about it. They've been really lovely to work with. And so that made it so much easier. And I would definitely work with them again, just because they were so flexible, you know, and so sweet, you know, because there was meetings where I was like, there might be a little baby turning up at some point if he wakes up, or, you know, and they were always like, yeah, totally welcome, it's fine, you know. So, you know, they've been just really lovely to work with. And I think just having that flexibility definitely makes me feel more open to working with them again.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Okay, so that's coming out in June. Can we pre-order? How do we get the book? What's the story?
Yeah, so it's available for pre-order now. You can find the book link on my website, which is www.rabbithatdesigns.com. And you can also find links on my Instagram, which is, the handle is Rabbit Hat Designs again. And yeah, and if you go to the link on my website, it will lead you to where you can get the book. And there's also a free pattern you can get if you pre-order as well, which is that's like a moth or a cicada. So that's kind of a fun little addition if anyone wanted to get it early. So the link's there.
And then it'll be available wherever books are sold once it's available?
Yeah, so it's available in lots of different places. Okay. I think, so it should be available in person from June, you know, when you go to a lot of different bookstores, especially craft stores and bookshops. Yeah. But it'll be available on lots of online stores as well.
And if it's from Amazon, it comes in a recyclable, completely recyclable.
I hope so. I don't know if I have any control over that. That is something I was thinking about, actually. I was like, oh, I wonder if I could request that, or, you know, how that would work. But I have no idea. I think it will depend on what Walter Foster's normal kind of packaging is. But I guess I could reach out to them, actually, now I'm thinking about it, and see about that. That's definitely something that's been on my mind. I was like, that'd be great if it came in one of those compostable ones or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure what it's like to work with Amazon, but
exactly.
I can about guess.
Part of the problem, because I think however big a company you are working, and then Amazon's an even bigger company, so it might be tricky to
right.
to have any kind of organization there. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, that's exciting. Have you seen have you seen a final version yet, or is that yet to come?
And so I've seen the version on a kind of form online. So, you know, where I've been able to edit a bit and work alongside them, you know, to get it ready. So I've seen the PDF version of the book, but I'm really excited to see it in person.
Right.
It'll be just so great to hold it. You know, I feel like when you put that energy and work into something and it's just fun sharing those patterns, it'll be so fun to see it, you know, in real life. So I'm excited about that.
Oh, that's got to be a huge, huge excitement, big payoff when you finally hold the book. Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, just that reality. Yeah, it'd be nice.
Yeah. Well, Beth, this has sure been a treat. Thanks for making the time to talk to us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been such a joy.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks to everyone for listening.